For episode 36, we're at Creative Equals Rise, an event in St. Luke's, a beautiful 18th century church converted into the home of the London Symphony Orchestra in East London. Creative Equals' mission is inclusive creativity, creativity for all, designed by all, within the communication and media industries. This episode will be split into two parts, owing to the volume of incredible speakers, panel discussions, and conversations. My co-host for the day is Ursie Downs, my colleague and Greater Than 11% alumni. You can catch her beautiful and candid interview, episode 17, in the playlist. As the agenda is literally bursting at the seams, we will be a tag team, aiming to translate key themes and sentiments over the course of the day. Ursie, welcome back to Greater Than 11%. What an honour to have you as my wingwoman today. It's going to be awesome. What are you looking forward to?
Well, thank you very much for having me back. It's been so wonderful to listen to all of the fantastic episodes this year. Today, I'm really looking forward to hearing Munro Bergdorf speak. I've been following her career and her activism for years, and I think she's a phenomenal force to be reckoned with. I also can't wait to hear the discussion this afternoon on why diversity matters with Natalie, June and Ali. I think that's going to be really interesting.
We'll be interviewing a number of speakers and panel guests at our location underneath the stage, bringing you the bustle of the day. Ursie will be on the ground, capturing interviews with those that are attending. But before we venture out and join the crowd streaming into the space, we're going to have a quick catch-up with Pip Jamieson. Pip is an incredible entrepreneur, having worked for the UK government, the Brit Awards, MTV, before founding The Dots, and she's been named one of the top 50 UK leaders by Creative Review. Pip, you're steering the ship today. Can you tell us about what your role is and what does it involve?
So today I'm MC, which is amazing to be invited back because I did it last year. And hilariously, I'm really badly dyslexic. So last year I muddled everyone's names. I got all the speaking notes wrong. And Ali invited me back today, which is really exciting. To be honest, it's like my favourite conference. And so I'm just really excited to be involved.
So this year's event is focusing on RISE, increasing the diversity of authors' message within the media and communication industry. What is needed to bring about change?
Gosh, you know, there's no silver bullet. I think, firstly, it's recognising that diversity is intersectional and there's multi-layers to it. It's not just about gender, ethnicity, LGBT. It's about neurodiversity, disabilities. And what I'm so excited about today is bringing all of that to the forefront and basically supporting each other, like everyone being each other's cheerleaders, because I really believe in the power of the collective and diversity should be inclusive. I'm hoping there's going to be loads of men in the room because in the end, if we all come together, we can all create a better future, and that's better for creativity, better for our industry, better for the bottom line. So I'm really excited about that.
Awesome. So why is Creative Equals so important?
Oh my God, the work Ali does and the team at Creative Equals is insanely important. I mean, the reality is we are a very long way to go. Gender's bad enough, but if you start looking at the other layers, it's actually shocking. But that's where the power of the collective comes in, and that's where the power of things like Creative Equals comes in. I mean, today is unbelievable because it's a conference bringing everyone together to support each other. But then all the other work that Creative Equals do, like the bursaries for internships, the returnships programs, is just amazing. And I just think we all have to support Ali. Or just be more like Ali. Maybe that's what we need to do.
Both.
Both.
Yeah. I agree. I definitely think so. So I don't know if you know, but I started this podcast because I came last year.
Amazing.
And yeah, so it's called Greater Than 11% because last year creative directors were at 11% in history. And I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's mental. Yeah. It's terrifying. But I suddenly go to places like this and suddenly realise we can change.
Definitely.
And is there this wave of amazing women coming through, mid-level talent coming through, junior talent coming through, and also this wave of incredible men that want to see it change too. Yeah. And so, yeah, I am an optimist, as you can probably tell.
Just a little.
Just a little.
Just a smidge of optimism. Cool. So what are you most looking forward to for today?
Oh, gosh, do you know what? I think it is just the diversity of speakers, but I love it that they're not just talking about diversity. I think it's talking about leadership. What do CMOs want? How do we measure the ROI of creativity? It's just not people talking about diversity. It's us talking about, and I guess, training the next generation coming through on the things that are important to their careers, which I think there needs to be more of, and that's why what Ali does is amazing.
What would you hope people leave with today?
I just hope everyone leaves with a sense of positivity and that we can change it. And it sometimes seems really hard from the inside, but then, like last year, I looked around the room and I was like, if we all come together, we can change it. And so, yeah, I hope that today everyone leaves with new friends, new networks, and then goes in and makes positive change within their industry. And if they can't make positive change within your own business, I think just go and be a founder. Start your own agency, start your own business, and make change that way, because sometimes, you know, fighting from the inside can be a bit hard too.
Awesome advice. Thank you so much, Pip.
Hello. Can you tell me your name and why you're here today?
Hi, my name is Rina. I'm a senior graphic designer. I'm here today at Rise because I just want to get inspired by a lot of amazing people in the industry.
Fantastic. And who are you looking forward to seeing most today?
Mira, the actress. I absolutely love her. I'm a big fan. So I'm quite interesting to hear what she has to say.
Hello, could you tell me your name and why you're here at Creative Equals Rise today?
Sure. I'm Lucy Eldridge, I'm a senior creative at Wonderman. I'm here at Rise today to be around lots of really inspiring people and hear inspiring talks and just feel a bit buzzed.
Cool, and who are you looking forward to the most today? Is there anything in particular on that agenda that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing Mary Portis because she's a proper ballsy lady. Like, she's made an amazing name for herself. I love her TV show. And and June Sarpong as well. I really want to read her book and I haven't got around to it yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Could you introduce yourself and tell me your name and your role?
I'm Alice Donnelly. I work at Kinetic, which is an out-of-home specialist, and I'm head of commercial delivery. So I guess I'm here to kind of learn from peers and other people in the field, learning what they're doing. That's really great. Where we can learn and be better and share what we're doing really well already.
Cool. And what are you hoping to kind of take away from today?
I'm hoping to be inspired. I have a feeling that's going to happen. There's so many fantastic people in the room. I think it'd be hard not to be. But then I think some kind of concrete new ideas, some fresh thinking, and hopefully a few contacts to, you know, kind of share war stories, share what's working well, what's not.
Super simple. We believe that diverse teams shape diverse work for diverse audiences. But just thinking about our audiences today, I just wanted to take a little moment to say I believe that we are living in unprecedented times. And I believe that unprecedented times call for extraordinary leaders. I would like to declare that we are actually facing, as a nation, an inclusion crisis. And I would say that we have, in my lifetime, and I'm quite old now, I would say that we're living in a time where we have some of the world's most non-inclusive leaders. Look at this bunch of leaders we have at the moment. There are just no words for Nigel Farage or Donald Trump. And look, Jeremy Corbyn, like, he's clearly anti-Semitic. You know, we are facing a complete inclusion crisis led by these non-inclusive leaders. And every day, you know, when I was thinking about this and thinking about this talk, you know, there are headlines that pop up that are truly shocking. And there's obviously a UKIP MP who thought it was acceptable to declare that he was thinking about raping another MP, Jess Phillips. Completely shocking. And of course, there was a big furore over the weekend about Oxbridge, who were accused of social engineering because they're planning to allow more state school pupils into Oxbridge. 7% of this country's population go to private school, and yet 36% of them end up at Oxbridge. So that's social engineering, one would say. But you know, the thing is, in this room today, as a holocracy, as a bunch of creative leaders, we have the power to change narratives. We have the power to put diverse and inclusive work out into society. And so thinking about, you know, society, now we've sort of been thinking about the work, let's also think about our teams. And one of the things that as Creative Equals we're really proud of is Last year we ran some government equalities funding, and we were able to run for the UK the first Creative Comeback programme of its kind. We've also set up for the sector the UK's first Creative and Media Equality Standard. We're actually partnering with the IPA, thank you to the incredible Leila Siddiqui, to bring the Equality Standard out to their members. It's a rating, review and a roadmap for all creative businesses, because actually the most important thing is having a roadmap. How are you going to really change and really drive that diversity and inclusion within your teams and within that work? And one of the biggest game changers of all has to come thanks to Claire Beale, who has been a complete trailblazer for diversity and inclusion in our industry. And actually, our equality standard for the first time appeared in the campaign school reports. And this was a completely a watershed moment. Only three companies have actually passed. So if you'd like to get your company accredited, please get in touch with us. And actually, because now we're sitting on all this data, we can see exactly what happens. We don't just look at gender, we look at ethnicity, we look at age, we look at LGBTQI, we look at disability, faith, class, etc. But what we've actually seen when it comes to creative women, that 75% of you still have a male boss. And what we know with creative careers is because they're all, the career progression is very vague, this can be super open to bias. Creative women are 10% less likely to have their work entered in for awards, and 12% of you are actually thinking about leaving the advertising sector. What we believe is creative women go to other parts of the creative sector. But what I would like to say to you today is stay. I believe that our glory days have yet to begin. When we can put diversity and inclusion right at the heart of our teams, our work, we can drive in an inclusion story for so many different audiences. Think of the impact that we can have. And we call it inclusive creativity. So today, as a Holacracy, I would like to invite you all to become part of an inclusive creative movement and really drive the change that we need to see.
Could you introduce yourself and tell me about your job role?
Hi, I'm Jess Morris, and I'm a creative at Adam and Eve DDB.
I'm Joanne Oates, and I'm a freelance creative.
What does diversity mean to you?
Making sure everyone's heard and has a voice. I think that includes the quiet people as well as the loud people, so yeah.
Just about creating like a rich society and a rich environment where everyone is equal and everyone's opinions matter the same, a place where everyone can share experiences.
My name's Eric Ng. I am the creative director of Design Studio.
And what does diversity mean to you?
I think what was really interesting from the this morning was this idea of tokenism. I think diversity should be organic, and it's actually more about being open and inclusive instead of actually just trying to tick boxes, for example.
So I'm Kat, I'm a copywriter at Flying Object. My company is very pro-diversity and equality, and they thought that whilst we're doing lots of projects internally, it might also be really helpful to get some outside points of view. So I'm here gathering notes, and I'm going to present back to the agency later, tomorrow probably. And I really enjoyed the chat by the CMOs and talking about ROI. I think it was really interesting the way they backed up the value that can be brought to a brand and a business by being diverse in your sort of audience understanding. And I thought that that was really interesting because it's making your brand culturally relevant to the community, and so of course then the investments will grow.
What does diversity mean to you?
I think it has to encompass everything. Of course, like the genders and the non-binaries, and then you're looking at everything from colour and heritage to neurodiversity, and then somebody once said it includes diversity of thinking. So just looking at all of these aspects together culturally, I think, is really interesting. So it's really cool that diversity as a term has grown. I feel like it's mushroomed in the past couple of years, and today is a great example of that.
We're now joined by Samantha Rank, actress, comedian, presenter and disability activist. She has starred in films such as The Little Devil and Surge of Power, Revenge the sequel. She's an ambassador for Parallel London, ADD International, Ability Bow, and she's also a patron for Head to Head Theatre Company. She's contributed some great content for Scope's Awkward Moments. She writes for the Huff Post with vulnerability, humour and intelligence. And in 2018, she made the SureTrust Disability Power 100 list. Today, she discussed I'm Not Your Token. Samantha, welcome.
Oh, hey. So nice to be here.
So great to have you. Can you give me a little bit of overview of what you just discussed?
So I basically wanted to look at the word token and tokenism. So I'd never heard of it until I started in the world of media. Mm-hmm. And it never really dawned on me what a powerful word that actually is until I did an appearance on Loose Women. It was my first time as one of the panelists, so mm-hmm. a massive achievement. And then as soon as it was over, like you do, you go straight onto social media and you start to have a look at, you know, the feedback. And on the whole, everyone was very complimentary. And then there was this one person who was someone also with a disability who just wrote in massive letters, token, exclamation point. Yeah. And I was like, oh, okay. So they think I'm just on there for a token. And it really kind of knocked my wind out a little bit. I thought, hang on a minute. How dare you? Yeah. Because I'd worked for 7 years to get to this point. I'm so proud of where I am. And if people just see me as a token, you know, a box-ticking exercise, then, you know, am I in the right industry? Do I want to be seen as a token? And, it, you know, I mulled over it for a while and I looked into, you know, kind of how media outlets need to fill quotas. They need to get that diversity up. But there is a fine line between being inclusive and diverse and being tokenistic. So, for example, you know, if you are going to tick a box and have a disabled actor, make sure that they are in a lead role. Mm. Don't have them as someone, you know, is maybe just in the background or is, you know, feeds into stereotypes, etc. But, you know, although it was really, really quite upsetting to begin with being called a token, I've actually come to embrace it and I've actually used it to my advantage. Mm. If I do tick a box, when do you know what? I'll tick it, I'll turn up, I'll do what you want to do. But actually, in the second half of the show, I'll do what I want to do. Yeah. And that has led on to more and more work. And I think I'm at a stage now where people, they now see my worth a bit more and they now say, hey, she knows what she's talking about and get me on even more projects. Yeah. So it hasn't necessarily been a detrimental thing for me, apart from maybe hurting my feelings. Mm. I think you're always going to get people that as soon as you see someone, a gay actor or a trans activist on television, they're just going to think, well, you know, they're a token. But if you think about it, there's nearly 14 million disabled people. So they could be using any of them, yeah. 14 million, but they've not. They've chosen me.
Yeah. And you've also worked bloody hard
yeah,
to get to
exactly.
where you are.
Like
you said, for 7 years. And in your, you know, talk, that was amazing. Talking about your journey, going from being a teacher, realising that you're unhappy and moving into acting and, you know, creating some great films, adverts, you're on Loose Women. It's just awesome. So, yeah. But why do you think, like, what I'm very curious about is tokenism and the term and it being either labelled or thrown at people. Why do you think that comes about?
Because first of all, they get cherry picked because, I mean, I've worked behind media, I've worked in front of the camera and then I've also worked in development and production. And I even have this sense of fear that they are not filling this quota and they've got to do this. And we've got to remember that still now, a lot of the big corporations and broadcasters, they are predominantly white middle-class men. And, you know, they've probably never met someone like me in their life. You know, that probably puts the fear of God into them a little bit because they have no way of being able to relate to these people. Mm-hmm. A third of all Brits feel awkward and uncomfortable around disability. That is a substantial amount. So I think the word comes from that. And also when people attack me or anyone else is saying you're a token, I think because they don't actually realise the work that's gone in.
Yeah.
Because all they've known for years is having a certain type of people on their radios, on their television screens, and all of a sudden there's this big influx of diversity. And I suppose they're just thinking, oh, they're just doing that just to be PC. Well, actually, no, you know, we're doing it because we want children, young children, to aspire when they see someone like themselves looking back at them on television screens. So it's, you know, so I think the general public don't actually grasp that what we're trying to achieve here. So for them, it might just be tokenistic. It because from one day to the next, you've gone from no diversity to, you know, like this amazing melting pot of different people.
Yeah. That is, like, my next question is about that. It's about fear. So I often feel it's on the shoulders of those with disability to educate people with, you know, experiences and to carve a space for representation. And I also feel that there's a lack of interest and a lack of self-education on the part of these people in the positions of power within advertising. So what are your thoughts on kind of developing real and honest dialogue around disability trying to break those systems of power constantly.
I always used to say when I got asked a very similar question to that way back when, you know, is it up to me to put myself out there? And I used to say, you know, ignorance breeds ignorance. And I understand, and I've done, you know, campaigns like End the Awkward campaign with Scope, you know, and done campaigns like What Not to Say to People with Disabilities. And the more I've kind of, I don't know whether it's age or the, you know, a bit more wisdom that I've got, but when I moved from a very white, you know, rural town in Lancashire, moved to London, and all my neighbours were from all different parts of the world. And I had to educate myself on Eid, on, you know, kind of their cultures, their celebrations. Because when they were having a party next door, I was going, what's this? You know, and it was because that was part of their faith, etc. So I think people actually, if it's 2019, I think people actually need to take a bit more responsibility and go, do you know what? We can't just sit back and go, well, it's up to you. I don't know a gay person, so I don't really care about gay marriage. Well, you should actually take a bit more ownership. But there's things that I can do as an individual, as a campaigner, and exactly what I'm doing now, better representation, putting myself out there, and actually getting the point across that people with disabilities are just people at the end of the day. We all want the same thing. We all want love. We all want respect, friendship. You know, we all want success. And how is that any different from anybody else? So I think, you know, just showing that on the surface or visually we might look different or we live our lives a little bit differently to yours, but that's nothing to be scared of and that's nothing to shy away from.
And I so love listening to your talk today. So love talking to you. Wondering if you can tell me what you've got coming up, because you mentioned a podcast when you were up on the stage.
Yes, so a good friend of mine, Dan Edge, who is also a actor and activist, he has cerebral palsy, and we've worked a lot together in past years, and whenever I've got something coming up, if I think that, you know, he'd be great to bounce off of, and we thought, you know what, why aren't we doing something together? Because we're good friends, we gel, so we've got a podcast coming up. It's still top secret. We're still working on the title. Okay. We're having arguments about the title. So I've got that. I suppose I can tell you, because it's probably going to be released by the time I'm filming Celebrity Antics Road Trip.
Oh,
yes.
Next
week. And I'm going to be back on the Jeremy Vine show as a guest panelist at the end of the month. So
relentless.
You know, and people, I can only plan 1 week at a time. Yeah. When people say, what are you doing? I'm like, actually, I don't know. But, you know, ask me in a couple of hours and I might have had a phone call to do something. But I'm loving what I'm doing. I love the creative industry. I love challenging myself. I love saying yes to things where maybe I should be having a rest. But life is good, and life is good for people with disabilities. I think, particularly if I was a younger person now, I'm so glad that I can potentially impact on their lives and show them that if they want to do something in the creative field, then it is doable, it's possible.
Uh-huh. Samantha, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank
I love
you.
Chatting to you.
Could you tell me your name and your job role? Introduce yourself for me.
I'm Helen Buzway. I work at an agency within Publicis called August Media.
How did you find the talks this morning? Who's your favourite?
Munro was fabulous. I think Samantha was really great as well. I think what I loved about Samantha's talk was the fact that it was very personal, and she was able, I think, to obviously talk about her experiences. And then when she was talking about something like tokenism, the fact that, which I understand because it's something that I struggle with. I think I watch television and I watch adverts, and as a woman of colour, you just like, you notice when there aren't any people of colour and there is no diversity, but then you also notice when it's actually not done with the right intent. So I think that that's quite it's something that people really have to take on board. It's always about where's this intent coming from, and the idea that ticking boxes, it actually makes things worse, I think, for the people that are on the margins or different or not like the binary norm that people, you know, that people have talked about. That thing where it said like being brave because you want to create stuff that you're going to be proud of in years to come is so important. And that's where tokenism, that's the absolute opposite of tokenism, because it's something that is built to last and that speaks deeply to people. And people with a brain and people with a heart, no, I think that whole thing about being led by your heart that Claire Beale said actually is really, really pertinent to everyone who's in this industry, where you have the privilege to speak, to go into people's homes and speak to those people and interrupt their life. You have their ears and their eyes. Use it properly. It's a privilege. Don't fill it with stupid candy floss stuff. Make a difference or whatever. And if you are going to entertain them, be Marmite and do it in a way that makes people belly laugh.
Richard Robinson is a managing partner of eConsultancy. Working with brands and agencies, he specialises in accelerating market performance, enabling digital transformation. He's an award-winning diversity advocate, and among many of his accolades, and there is many, he was named by the Financial Times as one of the UK's leading men championing women in 2017 and 2018. He is a regular writer for the Marketing Week and is sometimes a brand expert for Channel 5 and also a visiting lecturer at the European School of Advertising. Richard, you just shared a panel discussing what's keeping CMOs up at night. Can you give us a flavour of what was discussed?
One of the things that sometimes gets forgotten when we talk about gender or inclusivity or enabling diverse thinking and people to be working inside agencies is that the client, the marketer, the person who's physically paying the bills at the end of the day has a very important say in this. Because the simple equation is, you know, they are attempting to connect with customers and they're attempting to stimulate the customers to do something. You know, normally it's to spend some money on one of their products. And so they want the best, single best result that's going to come back from the agency. And in the UK today, if you take a really simple statistic, 67% of the UK's GDP is controlled by women. Whereas you have a situation in agencies where only 16% of executive creative directors are women, and only one in four senior agency leaders are women. So there is this imbalance between what the public is doing with their money, and in some categories, such as grocery shopping and house buying, you know, you're into the 90% are controlled by women. It's always felt to me strange that agencies would allow their teams to be over-dominated by men. Because when you talk to CMOs, as the panel did, they want the best work. They want the work which is going to have insights which are going to unlock the consumer, and then ideas which are going to stimulate the consumer to do something with their brand. And the panel was talking, I felt, very enthusiastically, passionately, forthrightly on the real need for having creative departments which better reflect the customers that they're trying to talk to and the customers that they're trying to influence. Ultimately, this is a game of behavior, influencing behavior. Mm-hmm. And if you've got people who can think clearly, I mean, one of the panelists was obviously saying that, you know, if an agency walks in and it's an all-male team, she'll automatically reject the agency out of sight because she believes that a one-dimensional approach to how you can create an idea and then articulate it and execute it is not going to give her the biggest response. I mean, sure, maybe it could be deemed to be a successful campaign, but it will not be as successful as it possibly could be.
You've chaired the panel for 3 years in a row now.
Yes.
For Creative Equals, and you're also very committed and very involved in equality, diversity, championing women. So can you talk a little bit about how you got involved in advocacy and focusing on inclusivity within the creative industry?
Yeah, so my journey began very straightforward format, actually, which was that I did a degree in history and educational studies. And as part of that, you have to do teaching practice in primary schools. And I remember going to teach in a primary school in a place called Temple Cowley, which is in Oxford. And on my first day in the school, the head teacher said, you know, this is Mr. Robinson, he's a new teacher, and there was, you know, lots of murmuring going on in the room and pointing from children who were, you know, 10 and under. And I obviously thought this because, you know, I was clearly a rock star of a new teacher and my ego was telling me that this was because I looked quite cool. In reality, I walked out of this assembly and was then surrounded by about four or five kids who were about eight. And they were harassing me and prodding me, but it was, you know, quite very vocally, and it wasn't necessarily the it was an economically disadvantaged estate that I was in the middle of teaching in. But these kids were very forcefully saying, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? Why are you here? What are you doing? And I said, well, I'm here to teach. And this kid who was at eight said, no, you're not, mate, because misters don't teach. And I remember this. It's like, you know, think about this. My first ever big teaching practice. I'm there on my first day. And in three words, he destroyed everything that I was doing. Misters don't teach. And he said what he saw. And what he saw was something that was way off the reservation for him, which was a man who was teaching. So I can't criticize a child. I mean, it was just, you know, he just had no concept that this was even possible, that a man could be a teacher. And then one of his mates said, oh, no, mate. I said, I'm sure you're here to just fix something, aren't you? Maybe you were here to cut the grass. I was like, oh, blooming egg. So I went into the staff room and they said, you know, yeah, that's right. We haven't had a male member of staff for 12 years. What's fascinating about that is that is the only experience I have ever had in my entire career of 25 years of any form of gender discrimination against me. And it was from an eight-year-old child. Not at any other point in time has anybody ever made any, I don't know, assumptions or commentary about me because of the fact that I'm a man or that I'm white or that I have a degree. It's always really stayed with me that, you know, I've been a client. I've worked in agencies, very senior level. I've been an intermediary, working pitch consulting, now running eConsultants, a lot of digital thought leader. Ultimately, the people behind the ideas and the executions and the insights, everybody must have a fair chance in the workplace. And when you think about intellect or opportunity, it is absolutely from birth put equally across all of us, regardless of what we look like or where we've come from. It seems ridiculous that therefore only a subsection of all of the people who get given all of the talent shared out equally are, for some reason, the people that look and sound like me, then seem to always end up in the decision-making positions in creative agencies, or the decision-making, you know, the FTSE 100 at the moment only has 6 female chief execs. You know, so therefore, you're sitting there kind of going, that's a ridiculous situation, because it cannot be that 94% of people at the top of their companies have to be men. You know, the overused joke that there are more people called Dave who are currently running FTSE 100 companies than there are women, you know, which is farcical. So I got involved because my whole career has been in client service. You know, I am quite good at connecting people. I'm quite good at making things happen. So therefore, I have clients in whatever capacity always talking to me. They always need help. I always say, you know, these are people who are senior enough to ask for help. These are people who know that they have a problem, but more often than not, they haven't articulated what their problem is because they're facing into something they've never experienced before. There's a lot of deconstruction and unlearning that needs to happen in the workplace if we are going to deliver the best ideas and the best insights. And I think when senior clients are talking about, you know, well, I need some help, you know, for what, you know, this creative agency isn't performing, we're not understanding how to connect here, we don't really understand this digital insight, can you help me because I don't know, my programmatic or e-commerce doesn't really work. What they're actually saying is, I need some people who are going to come in here and unlock this and really work out how to connect with my customer. More often than not, the slightly lazy way that people have gone through hiring, normally taking short-term decisions to find the talent, does not enable them to fulfill their objectives. So people need to lean in, whether it be somebody that looks and sounds like me or not, people need to lean in and engage and ensure that all talent is going to have an equal place in the workplace. If we believe that, we want Britain, UK, London to still be at the top table of creativity and strategy. And the statistics I was using earlier that, you know, the commercial creative industry in the UK receives £19 billion worth of investment from businesses, brands, etc. And it has a proven return on investment of 6-1. So £120 billion is returned to the UK economy as a consequence of what we all do for a job. And everybody gets very excited about that statistic. And I look at that statistic and it makes me a bit sad, to be honest, because if we're in an economy where 67% of GDP is controlled by women, directly and indirectly, then I think that 6-1 is a failure, not a success. I believe that if we really wanted to stimulate growth in the UK economy, which God it needs at the moment, then actually I think the 6-1 is too small. I think that if we were able to balance out people in decision-making positions inside our creative industry, whether that be clients, whether that be agencies, I think you're going to find that return on investment is going to go up even higher. And then we're going to find that the £19 billion actually becomes £200 billion coming into the UK economy. We congratulate ourselves on this 6-1, which, don't get me wrong, is brilliant, but I think it's too low. And I think just changing the makeup, whether that be gender, it might be ethnicity, it might be sexuality, it might be neurodiversity, but changing the makeup of the people within it, because it cannot be that people that look and sound like me have a monopoly on all the ideas and the executions, because that's just weird to think like that. You have to think bigger than that and find the people who are going to connect properly.
Thank you so much for your time today, Richard.
That's okay, thank you.
Could you start by introducing yourself and telling me about your job role?
Yes, so I'm Lindsay Gormley and I'm Director of Marketing and Fundraising for the Film and Television Charity.
Who's been your favourite speaker of today?
Oh my goodness, what a question! The panel discussions have been really good. The quality around about that was excellent. And I think as somebody who's worked agency side and client side, I probably really enjoyed the panel about what's keeping CMOs awake at night.
So, could you introduce yourself and tell me about your job role initially?
I'm Emma Ford. I'm part of the account direction team at Flamingos.
And what brought you to Creative Equals today?
I think as a gender, females are always downtrodden or have been in the past, and I feel like that change is happening. And events like this really encourages you to be empowered. I mean, I've certainly felt very empowered throughout today, and I'm looking forward to having that voice.
So we're joined by Marie Tanguy, CEO of MTR Agency. Having been an advocate for artists from a young age, managing her first gallery at 21, she created MTR in 2015 with the focus on breaking the gallery model and to promote artists themselves. Mimi Gray is head of visual content at MNC Saatchi, has a background in PR, art and advertising, In her current role, she specialises in talent scouting, commissioning artists for up-and-coming campaigns. She set up the gallery space within the agency and has also been a DNAD New Blood judge. She and Maureen have set up Visual Diet, which they've just spoke about, at the event today, encouraging creatives or anyone to view, ingest content that inspires and nourishes them. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
And I'm wondering if you could maybe give us a little overview of what you discussed this morning.
Sure. Yeah. So we believe that, in a nutshell, much like you are what you eat, you sort of you are what you see and you feel what you see, and all of the images that you see over the course of a day have a sort of cumulative effect on your mood, how you feel about yourself and also the world around you. So this goes from like images of violence that you see on the news in the morning, plastic floating in oceans, to your friends' sort of Instagram posts, adverts, everything. So we're here to sort of try and empower people to balance their visual diets and to think about what makes them feel good and bad, and just to sort of address it, really, put the power in their hands.
Yeah, and I guess from the talent perspective first, we're trying to also show who is posting and who is creating that visual content. How can we make sure that we give the voice to the talents that are, you know, pushing a content that's much more inspiring? In the presentation earlier, we gave the example of a Kim Kardashian that will be mainly posting on something quite objectifying or narcissistic or sexualized. And it's, again, us endorsing that person to have that fame. So can we just rethink who are we endorsing so that hopefully the people that we endorse are giving us something that's incredibly visually inspiring instead?
There's a reason why Kim Kardashian has so many followers. It is enjoyable to look at, but what we don't see is the sort of like the work that goes into that. So the 3 hours that she'll spend a day doing her makeup, all the money, the personal trainers, the meals are being cooked for her, the plastic surgery, everything. Like, it's not real. Mm-hmm. And we forget that. It's really easy to forget that on Instagram, and to compare yourself to people that you can't even believe you really share the same world with.
So can I talk about how it came about, how you kind of came up with the concept and started working together on this?
So I've got, in terms of my background, I was spent a year in LA when I had my own gallery, and I was basically exposed to the fame. How do you make people famous? I think Hollywood and Los Angeles are very much, that's their expertise. But what concerned me is that every person that was, you know, had that kind of fame that I would talk to, again, had a content that I felt, you know, was not the most inspiring. And as a young person, I wanted role models, and I was disappointed in terms of the role models I was being offered. So I decided to kind of return to London and create an agency that will shape a new type of role models. And I wanted those role models to be in the arts because that was my space. So I just basically gave that first speech when I started the agency saying, wouldn't it be nice that instead of Kim Kardashian having this 100, I started with her. That's the reason why she was a thread for me. That instead we empower someone that talks about sustainability or gender issues and who is a very inspiring artist, and we'll kind of really rethink the visual content. I left it there and thought that was it in terms of the comparison. But then Ted approached to do a talk on that subject because I felt that everyone talks about addiction to technology, but very few talks about addiction to the wrong visual content on the technological platform. And then I met this very passionate and obsessive person called Mimi. And I told her this mad story. And she was like, oh, my God, this is the subject I want to be covering. Yeah. So I think she became even more obsessed than I on the subject, to be honest with you. And I felt it was so right to get on board an advertising agency because, again, it is really about who has power to make a change. Mm-hmm. And I felt that, you know, an advertising agency has way more reach than the art industry would have. So it was a dream at that point, and that's how Mimi led it with Ranking. Mm-hmm. And kind of shaped the project with us on that basis.
Yeah, I mean, Maureen came in to speak with me after her TED Talk, and obviously I'd seen it, and I was just like, yes, like this. I've been thinking about this for so long, and been trying to have this conversation with people, but I feel like at that time, which must have been about a year ago, it wasn't sort of the conversation that it has become now. So now, you know, it's great for the project and for just society in general that we are talking about mental health a lot, and we are speaking about screen time and the types of apps we go on. We know that Instagram is the worst sort of social media platform for mental health. It has the worst statistics to do with that. So what we wanted to look at was like, why is this? Because it's not just down to screen time and this sort of antisocial aspects of it, because we really believe that it's what you're seeing. And there's areas where this has been proven. Like, we know that art is very therapeutic. It's used, well, actually in Canada at the moment, Canada seems to be really ahead of the curve. In Canada at the moment, doctors are trialling sort of gallery and museum visits for patients with mental health problems. They're also at the moment trialling Instagram without the likes, so you can't see the like count on your photos. Yeah. And they're sort of looking into what effect that has on how we post and the type of content we post.
Yeah, and that is really a type of content. That's what Canada is doing. So what's interesting coming from the art sector, it's been 100 years that we know that art and mental health have something to do with each other, especially with creativity in that sense. So like after the war here, second war, people were sent to art school to recover from trauma. It's something that's really old. We all know about it. But yet we accept to be bombarded with a visual content that is harmful. Mm-hmm. But we've had countless studies, and it is something that you know as well, very well.
Definitely. The other thing is we're still just sort of like toddlers in this digital age, so we really don't know what the effect is yet of the content that we're consuming and the rate at which we're consuming it, which is just, it's like nothing has ever happened before. But like Maureen said, what we do know is the positive benefits of art, and we just sort of want people to just take stock of everything they're looking at, to think about it and balance it. And it doesn't have to be about art. Obviously, we're both pretty obsessed with art and can't think of anything better to look at. But, you know, it could be animal videos or like ASMR or, I don't know, someone funny like Celeste Barber. I love her account and it just makes you feel good.
Yeah. So I wonder if we can talk about maybe your individual roles outside the visual diet. So, Marine, can we start with you, MTR Agency? Can you give me a bit of background of why you started it and how it functions? Because it is a disruptor within the art world.
Yeah.
That's why I love it.
Oh, I'm glad. So, basically, it's been running for almost 4 years, so it's turning four in June. It's like a toddler, so it feels so proud that now it can be in a different toddler. I guess the agency runs like any other agency you have in music, sports and film, where you have hundreds of artists applying to you. Then you have a selection committee that will pick the best ones. And then basically we have two groups of artists. We have the artists we invest in, which means we cover their studio and production costs and we're completely behind in establishing their profile. And we have the artists on the books who we think the art is great, but we're not going to tell you this is the next star. So I think that's kind of in terms of the structure of the agency. What it does mean is that I'm incredibly close to people who are incredibly passionate. And I was saying this in a very emotional way to Adelaide last night, who just performed, because we just returned from Paris, where she just opened Museum Week. And I was saying to her in a very Jerry Maguire embarrassing way, I was like, this is exactly the reason why I love doing my job. I love that your phone is bombarded with people trying to do things with you. I love that we're strategizing. I love that you are inspiring people. I love seeing people being inspired as you kind of walk on stage, or you know, people looking at your work. So I think the job is really to kind of ring people, meet people every single day, whether it's me or my team, and making sure that, you know, they see how inspiring the talents we have are. But it's a joy, like when she walked on stage on Monday, to kind of look at all the eyes that just goes on her and stop, and you can hear the pin drop, and it's the biggest reward. So it's a daily reward, and you just are a very people person, I think, because you need to make sure that you match your artist to the top people in either in public spaces, either in brands, either collectors, either investors, either digital. But ultimately, you're trying to create value for the two people that you're putting in the same room. So yeah, it's a very amazing job. I'm very lucky.
That's great. And Mimi, what about you? Because you're looking at talent quite a lot, but you also set up the gallery within MC Saatchi, which is an awesome thing to do. So can you talk a little bit about your role and then setting up the gallery?
Yeah, so my role, for anyone that knows advertising or works in the industry, is essentially a sort of art buyer role, which sadly seems to be on its way out, which I think is just terrible. It's the biggest mistake ever. But I'm incredibly lucky because our chief creative officer, Justin Tindall, is, you know, quite art obsessed as well. He was part of the sort of YBA year at Goldsmiths College. And so he's been so supportive. I was like, you know, we work in a creative agency. The space is not creative. You know, we need art. We need artists talking, doing workshops. And so much of a creative's role is actually just sitting at their desk and working on a laptop. And they're not really exposed to as much interesting stuff as they should be. So there again, for a creative, having an amazing visual diet is maybe the most important, because you want to be looking at all kinds of different cultural references, art references, from stuff from different cultures, and not just be in like your own echo chamber. So like Maureen, I'm, you know, people person. The best part of my job is meeting artists and photographers, illustrators, I love that. It's what like keeps me really energized at work. So I try and meet an agent and an artist every day in amongst my other meetings. And that just means that I sort of, when a creative comes to me with a brief, I'm able to say like, I've just seen this amazing person, or, you know, it was just a graduate show from one of the unis and this person might be really interesting, or this artist is doing something to change the planet and like, you know, let's sort of try and increase the visibility of meaningful content and meaningful artist work.
It's both evident you both love your jobs, which is awesome.
I don't think it's a job anymore, is it?
Yeah. But you also have like such a direct hand in diversity, equality, spreading, you know, what we see and how we incorporate. You know, how do you keep on board and how do you keep diversity front of mind?
You just have to be constantly aware of your privilege. So, I mean, both us as individuals, the roles that we're in, the agencies that we're in, the city, everything, and just try and give a hand up to amazing people who aren't getting the visibility that they need. Yeah, it's always front of mind. It's just you need to think about this responsibility every day.
I think from my end, so I come from queer and elitist industry because the art world is the definition of elitism in that sense. I tried to be art world elitist initially because we were told this is what it takes to be successful. So I was a young Gary Major, 21, in a very kind of the way I should be speaking. I even remember embarrassingly to pretend I had a posh accent because I was also told that I had to talk like I had a hot potato in my mouth, which was really embarrassing when I looked at the video. But I did all that because, again, my industry told me you have to be that person. So, again, I tried to be that person, but I think, sadly, resulted, as I said, in a burnout and something that was very unhappy. So when I rebuilt Empty Arts, for me, it just, I didn't care what people could say in the industry. What I cared was that the philosophy and the values we were setting those foundations on were solid. Because I, again, it goes back to mental health. So I wanted to make sure we could talk about them, we could carry them with strength, and we could believe in them. So what's interesting about it is that we don't have a single diversity issue. Our process to application is open. So whatever artist you, whoever, wherever in the world you are, you can submit an email. And I think in terms of our artists, you know, it's interesting because if we even look at the gender inequalities in our industry, there's so few women artists at the top. For me, we're 50-50 without even thinking about it. We never thought, okay, let's get one boy, let's get one girl. Mm-hmm. It's just realistically, people of talent are diverse. Mm-hmm. And if you only really look at that aspect, you would end up having a pretty diverse crew. I haven't had to think, oh dear, I need to get women on board. Every time I got women on board is because they generally were incredible.
I have exactly the same thing. And so many people in industries, directors or photographers are like, you know, just the talent's just not out there, or it's extra hard to find, and, you know, everyone's really stretched, we don't have the time to look. But I'm just like, you know, without thinking about it, again, I'm finding all these like incredible talents, and I just think it's lazy on the part of a commissioner's side to think, assume that the people aren't there. And if you have to look a bit harder, then fine, that's your job, do it.
But it's also a thing because all these industries, and it's the same with funding industries or investment industries, they are per recommendations. And so most people will never put an open call. They will actually be asking people to recommend them. That is exactly what we're dealing with. So again, having a fair application process for us is very new in terms of the industry. But that's actually the issue because people are there. But of course, if you just go in your network, if I just go in my network, I will have people a bit like me. That makes complete sense. My friends are quite similar. Mm-hmm. This is still what we hear a lot in the art industry, that, oh, but we've put it through the friends.
Yeah.
That's how we end up having something that's unequal. Yeah. If you don't have an open call with a clear brief where everyone can apply.
Thank you so much, guys, for catching up.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Cool.
So could you start by introducing yourself to me and telling me about your job role?
Hi, I'm Lizzie. I'm a sales planner at Spotify. And what do you hope to kind of take away from today to kind of incorporate diversity into my thinking? In all parts of my job generally. There's a lot about kind of personal well-being, which I think is really useful, like the imposter syndrome. The lady who just spoke then, who's talked about kind of like the wage gap and negotiations, that's definitely something that I need to, most women do definitely, but I do definitely need to improve. I think just generally some really great tips and always having like inclusivity.
Artist Adelaide DeMoa has just performed for Rise. Using paint on her body and her face, she was working with a canvas. With a focus on generating spontaneous communication between herself and the audience through performance, she is represented by Marine Tangay of MTA Art. Adelaide, so you've just performed your performance upstairs, which was amazing. I'm wondering if you could give us a bit of a description of what the performance was and what happened.
So it's called #MyFace. And with this performance, I was specifically focusing on my face because with the visual diet idea, I was asked to come up with a performance in response to that idea. Mm-hmm. So short backstory, just to give some context, is that I actually suffer from a condition called endometriosis. And it's that condition that brought me to art in the first place. But as a result of that condition, it's a female condition that affects the womb. I had to take the pill continuously for years. So I've been on the pill since like 2011 or something. Mm-hmm. And as a direct consequence of the sun interacts with something in the skin related to the pill that causes hyperpigmentation, and you get a very distinct pattern on your face. Mm-hmm. So it kind of looks like a stain. And up until that point, I've always had pretty good skin. And so I became very, very self-conscious about that. So when the whole concept of visual diet came up and they asked me to do a performance relating to it, it made complete sense to use my face to talk about body image issues and the impact of, I suppose, the pressure to be perfect from social media and how that affects mental health. Mm-hmm. So going back to the idea of #MyFace, the performance involved me coming on stage wearing very heavy Instagram makeup, which I don't usually wear. I usually wear quite natural looking makeup. So you can still see that I've got this thing, yeah. But it kind of blurs it. But with the heavy Instagram makeup, I slapped on loads and loads of foundation and used the contouring and the highlighting and the fake eyelashes and big bright red lipstick and basically a mask. Mm-hmm. So it's not how I would usually appear, mm-hmm. but it's also a reference to the way that so many people will sort of use filters and things on Instagram to make themselves look better than they are actually in real life, mm-hmm. which is another thing that's adding pressure for young people. So going on stage like that and facing the audience and the audience seeing my face and then removing that makeup in front of the audience so then the audience can see what my real face looks like mm-hmm. without any makeup at all and seeing that hyperpigmentation. I'm then really vulnerable and really exposed. And it's not only exposing what my real face looks like, it's also exposing a condition. So I'm wearing my condition on my face, mm-hmm. essentially, even though probably most people wouldn't guess that that's what's going on. They just think I've got some kind of weird hyperpigmentation on my mm-hmm. face. But for me, from a personal perspective, that's what it feels like. I'm exposing mm-hmm. that condition. And then after that is exposed, I then use clown makeup, essentially, white clown makeup, cover my face with that, and then print my face onto a black canvas that's on the floor. And the white and the black is just for contrast, really. And when you see the end result, the end piece, it kind of looks X-ray-like. Mm-hmm. And unless you're at the performance, sometimes people who see the piece without seeing the performance don't really know what's happening. Mm-hmm. They can just see this kind of weird X-ray-looking image. And after I finished printing my face, I then write how I was feeling in the moment and what I was thinking in the moment, and just really a display of complete honesty and transparency written on the canvas. And then that's the end of the performance.
Wow. And you are super vulnerable by doing that. When you're talking through, I was just like, yeah, how do you mentally prepare yourself? Because you've got an audience there. You are, like you're saying, you've put a mask on, you're taking the mask off, and then you're performing with paint and your face, and then emotionally writing, you know, what's coming out. So how do you prepare for that?
Yeah, I have a routine. Mm-hmm. I have like a process that I go through for each performance. Ideally, I like to check myself into a hotel near to the place where I'm going to be performing, mm-hmm. and I do a face mask, and I meditate, and I do a bit of yoga, and really get myself into the zone. And then at the same time, that didn't happen today because I don't live too far away, mm-hmm. so there was no point in doing that. But it's essentially because I had the green room, I sat there and I calmed myself, meditated for a few minutes, and I have mantras that I go through, mm-hmm. and I also try to channel one of my ancestors, who is a lady called Ama Amasa Kwanzaa, that is my maternal great-grandmother, mm-hmm. and I found a picture of her that was taken in 1920, holding my grandmother, who I'm actually named after. Mm-hmm. And she was a very powerful looking woman. Mm-hmm. You know, she was like 6'4", mm-hmm. really beautiful, really striking yeah. lady. before I do a performance, I kind of, after the meditation process, I go through these chants in my head where I'm saying, I am Amasakwansa, I am power. And I say that over and over and over and over again. And so by the time I go onto the stage, I'm like, I feel elevated. I feel like my back is straight. I feel strong, you know. That's how I get myself into the zone every time.
Cool. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to using art as this expression? Because it is very expressive and it is very bodily, but it's also very emotional and cerebral. Like you've combined everything. So can you talk about how you your path to this?
I got my degree in applied biology. I graduated in 1999. After graduation, I went on to work for a pharmaceutical company doing pharmaceutical sales. But that whole time during my study, I was suffering with endometriosis. I didn't know what that was. Mm-hmm. And the doctors, they kept on saying, you're having painful periods, but nobody was able to tell me what was happening. I was in and out of hospital and I was getting misdiagnosed all over the place. And it was only when I started working for a big pharmaceutical company where I had private medical cover, and that's when I got my diagnosis as being endometriosis. Mm-hmm. Having the endometriosis meant that during my period working in pharmaceuticals, I had prolonged periods of absence. And during those prolonged periods of absence, I got to explore my work. And the painting is something that I had been doing from school days. I did GCSE art. I didn't do A-level art or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I fell in love with art really when I was probably 13 or 14. And I had been using it as a crutch and as a therapeutic tool. Mm-hmm. And so that was a habit that I continued into my adulthood.
Yeah.
So when I was working, everybody knew that I was an artist on the side.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really take it seriously. It was just something, it was a comfort to me and it was my personal thing. And it got to a stage when it was around 2004. I had been off work for a very long time. It was a few months, like 5 or 6 months. And I'd really done a deep dive into oil painting and really trying to teach myself various old master techniques. I was still very green and not very good, but friends and family started buying the work. And then I had this light bulb moment. But because I knew nothing at all about the art world and I was coming from a business and science background, my instinct was to go to a business networking event. So in 2005, I went to, there was this event called Mind of a Millionaire. I met Simon Woodruff of Yo Sushi and Alexandra Mosu, at the time R&B Ringtones, and I made friends with these people and they gave me advice. And at the same time, I also met a man called Emil Emiabato, who was a businessman, and I was walking around with my portfolio of naive artwork, and he said, I think you're ready for a solo show. I said, I don't think I am. I've only ever done really small pieces. He said, no, I think you can do it. So basically, he was good friends with a man called Charlie Allen. He had a boutique in Islington called Charlie Allen's Boutique. He was a tailor to the royal family, actually, still there, and said, we'll give you this space, beautiful space. It looks like an art gallery. It's not, it's a shop. And so that was where I did my first exhibition, and I was covered by the BBC, Channel 5 News, and so I got lots of media attention. I wasn't ready for that media attention at that time because I really wasn't that good, but luckily, I think I was wise enough to kind of step back after the event and really just go back into my practice and keep making more work. I kept on having more exhibitions after that. And then it was really, I suppose, 2011, I started doing artist interviews because I had another period of really intense illness where I was in and out of hospital for about a year or so. But I still wanted to keep my feet in the art world. And I still was very aware that I was so naive about the art world and I knew nothing. And I wanted to learn, how does one become successful in the art world? What does it take to become a success? Who are the people that I need to connect to? What friends do I need to make? So I started doing these interviews in order to cultivate relationships and also to develop my network, while at the same time learning as much as I could about what it took to be successful. So the questions that I was asking were very much about success. What does it take to be successful in the art world? What are the challenges that you have to overcome? How do you overcome those challenges? And I was interviewing people at all different levels of their career, from people who were just graduating from university to people who were like 80 years old and had massive careers. I was interviewing gallerists and dealers, and started by putting these interviews on my blog, and then progressed to doing video interviews. And it was during the time when I was doing the video interviews that I met and made friends with an amazing artist called Rachel Arra, who's a really good friend of mine now. And she gave me a critique of the last solo show that I did before the last one, which was called This Is Us, where it was very much me trying to do the old master painting style, using text to try and tell stories about women in a relationship. And it was LGBTQ type of thing, stories that I was trying to tell. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, I don't feel like you're successfully telling this story using these techniques. Mm-hmm. You need to really think differently, outside of the box, really push yourself. You're more than this. Your presence is more than just painting in the way that you're doing in mm-hmm. this traditional way. And it was kind of like a kick in the guts at first, to be honest. It was really painful to hear. But at the same time, it was good because it meant it forced me to really go back into the studio and reevaluate everything that I was doing. And then I somehow went back to research that I had done previously about Eve Klein. Then I discovered Anna Mendieta and David Hammond. And somehow it just hit me that I have to use my body. So I started tentatively using my body in the studio. Mm-hmm. And in the process of doing that, I was filming myself just so that I could have a record of what mm-hmm. I was doing. Then it occurred to me that this is very performative. Even though I was doing it in front of a camera, there's no one there, it was still a very performative thing. Mm-hmm. And it was like a natural progression mm-hmm. to then take that to performance. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I ended up doing the performance. And then after that, then it made sense to attach all kinds of different social issues to that, because that's what I was trying to do before. I was trying to talk about social issues. I was trying to talk about things that were important to me, whether it was body image or race or sexuality or gender or, you know, colonialism, mm-hmm. all of these things that I'm really interested in and passionate about, that I wanted to express through my work, that I was frustrated that I wasn't able to get across everything I wanted to using the techniques that I was using. And this was the perfect way of doing it.
And it is so powerful. I mean, if anyone's listening, they can see it on YouTube. It's so incredible.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time. I so loved talking to you today your amazing performance upstairs. Part one has been epic. What a real joy and honor to speak to so many creative and focused people. If you enjoyed the first part, you can catch the second half of the event, part two, in the playlist, where we hear from Mary Portis, Ursi Downs has a mentoring session with Natalie Green from Uncommon, and we also include a snippet from a 300-strong fishbowl. If you enjoyed this podcast, it would be amazing if you could subscribe, rate, and write a review, as it makes a huge difference in it reaching others. This podcast is made possible with the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency. A huge thank you to the editors Daniel Clark and Laura Francis.